Well, good evening and welcome, friends, to Voices of the Sacred Feminine, whether you're across town or across the globe. That cut opening tonight's show is from an artist I'm rotating back in, named Morgan Baum, and the cut is Song of the Siren. Well, I wonder how you spent summer solstice last weekend. On Saturday night, for me, I was at the Goddess Temple of Orange County in Irvine, California, when the newly installed, larger-than-life-size statue of the Egyptian goddess Sekhmet, the lion-headed goddess, was consecrated and witnessed by a packed house of women and men on hand to welcome her to her new temporary home. You can see some of the pictures I've posted on my show page. High atop her 4-foot-tall, pyramid-shaped base, Sekhmet dominated the room in regal splendor. It was hardly a surprise. During the instant of her unveiling, the smoke alarm suddenly went off and the lights began to flicker, leaving no doubt to all assembled she was definitely in the sanctuary. The evening was filled with music, singing, dancing, drumming, and recitations to dispel the disinformation about her most well-known myth. A patriarchal myth, perhaps designed to cause women to be feared or women to fear their own power. Sekhmet, a solar deity known today to help women and men transform and empower themselves, is rising at a crucial time in our history. Have no doubt she is on the rise as people strive to find their strength, tenacity, passion, creativity, courage. Sometimes we call that their sacred roar. Turn on the news and there's hardly a place families, women, workers, animals, or Mother Earth herself are not under assault. Banks are still foreclosing on family homes with questionable legal authority. Women are under assault as Republican congresses across the country attempt to thwart their access to birth control and demand they be penetrated with unwarranted, unprescribed, and unwanted probes for exercising their constitutional right to an abortion. Dare I say these government-licensed rape of women are just one of the many shameful indignities being imposed upon women across the country by religious zealots using their power and political office against women and their rights to their own bodies. Voters, too, are under assault across the nation as white power brokers and the Republican Party use any means available to them to rig voting districts, denying majorities of liberal, brown, and black-skinned people their real representatives in office. Workers continue to suffer from their corporate oppressors, oftentimes not making enough money. Even after working a 38-hour week, they still can't pay for health care and feed their families. Sometimes they're forced to apply for taxpayer-funded food stamps. Animals across the globe suffer every day in horrendous conditions of factory farms. Mother Earth is under assault by all measure of corporate abuse, the least of which is one of the newest threats to drinking water across the country from fracking practices of the energy companies. Genetically modified food, pink slime, and frankenfish all potentially threaten the public welfare. Sekhmet, like Kali, the Morrigan, Libertas, and other political and warrior goddesses, are available to women and men the world over as they stand shoulder to shoulder seeking social justice and equality for all. Well, I'd just like to say the community is so grateful to the initiates, Melissae, and presiding priestess Ava for their work in the world holding center for goddess spirituality in Orange County, the oldest and original religion of the earth that humanity in modern times can all share and celebrate. We honor, too, the sacred performers, Vajrama, Laura Kane, Liz and Meredith, Miranda Rondeau, Sahira, Nancy Johnson, and Carolyn Amore. Special thanks and gratitude goes to the many people working for months to bring Sekhmet to the temple and make this event such a success. Mata, Marsha, Stan, Michelle, Gina, Raven's Eye, Steve, Oberon, Jeff, Roy, and Karen Tate. Yep, that's me and my honey. For anyone wanting to visit the newly installed Sekhmet at her temple, please consult the hours of operation and the events calendar of the Temple of Orange County, the Goddess Temple of Orange County.com. Well, turning our attention to tonight's show, our first guest is Carl McColeman, discussing the hidden dimension of the divine feminine within Christian mysticism, along with a perfect example of this in the personages of Julian of Norwich, medieval mystic, who wrote about the motherhood of God following a mystical vision she experienced in the year 1373. We'll delve into why it's important mainstream Christians excavate this tradition of the divine feminine in their own history, both as a way of fostering positive relations between mainstream Christians and practitioners of goddess-centered paths, as well as in the interest of deconstructing the unhealthy patriarchy that continues to plague the mainstream church. In the second half of the show, Virinda Pooja, teacher on the Vedic influences on humanistic psychology, healing, and social sciences and other Western disciplines, who's written on the need to bring integral yoga and Vedic principles into education, leadership, and parenting so we might generate compassion for positive transformation in society, discusses with me goddesses mothering women, goddess mothering women wisdom leaders, and our goddesses and women mothering peace on earth. If you tuned in recently, you heard me talking to Reverend Lorianne Vidney, Archpriestess of the Fellowship of Isis and Priestess of the Temple of Isis, discussing her book, The 42 Ideals of Ma'at. Well, silly me, I didn't get around to reading all 42 of those ideals, so I thought over the next couple weeks I'd read them to you. So tonight I'll read the next 10. I have only good intentions, is number 11. I relate in peace. I honor all creatures with reverence. I can be trusted. I care for the earth. I keep my own counsel. I speak positively of others. I am balanced in my emotions. I am honest in my relationships. And number 20, I aspire to higher consciousness. Next week, I'll share the next 10 until I've read the entire 42 ideals of Ma'at, that's the Egyptian goddess of truth and justice. Well, okay, I think it's about time to turn my attention to tonight's guest. I'm so glad to have with us Carl McColeman. Let me tell you a bit about Carl before we begin our chat about Christian mystics and the divine feminine buried in Christian history. I usually don't read someone's entire biography, but Carl's story is pretty interesting. I thought it would, I think you'd really enjoy hearing more about who he is, and he's had an interesting life. He says, in the summer of 1992, I was in a rather nasty car accident. It left me with a jaw broken in several places, a few missing teeth, lacerations along one arm, and a total vehicle. After surgery, leaving my mouth wired shut about 6 weeks, no easy feat for this enthusiastic speaker, and the purchase of a shiny new Saturn sedan, I met with my spiritual director to sort out my feelings. There I was, a young man who had had a brush, if not with death, at least with what could have been a far more serious accident. What meaning could I squeeze out of such a turn of events? On the surface, I felt I was living a wonderful life. I was dating a lovely woman, enjoying a successful career, managing a bookshop at a wonderful college, living in a beautiful cottage tucked in the woods of Tennessee's Cumberland Plateau, and feeling nothing but confidence about my future. And then I got a few teeth knocked out of my mouth and perhaps some sense knocked into me. For, I suppose, like many people do, I had given up or paid scant attention to some dreams in order to pursue others. Is that a bad thing? Well, probably not. But in the aftermath of my accident, it was time to rethink just how I was steering the course of my life. I realized that two key elements of my life were far from starving for lack of attention. I loved to write, but was so busy living my fun, carefree life that I barely bothered to keep a personal journal, let alone write for others. Perhaps even more crucial, I hungered for intimacy with God, an intimacy I knew could be fostered by prayer, meditation, and contemplation, thanks to a rather dramatic experience of God's presence I had when I was a teenager, followed by several formative classes in Christian spirituality taken at the Shalom Institute shortly after I finished my degree. Like my writing, spirituality was something I said was important to me, but in all honesty, I had not made much of an effort to practice a daily commitment to prayer. Writing and prayer, word and silence, wisdom and emptiness, these two neglected longings in my soul were what I most yearned to make a real part of my life. As a friend I would meet a decade later would say, these two things had me in their confidence. It's not so much that I wanted to pray and I wanted to write. It's more than writing and prayer. It's more that writing and prayer wanted me. So I wrote and I prayed and I sat in silence and I tried to do these things every day. None of it was perfect, but I learned to be okay with imperfection. And within 5 years of the accident, my first book was published, a rather generic meditation on the spiritual life called, appropriately enough, Spirituality. More books followed, covering a wide range of interests and perspectives on the inner life at the turn of the millennium. For a few years, I turned away from the faith of my childhood and explored the colorful world of goddess spirituality and Celtic paganism, spurring in me a deep respect for interfaith dialogue, but also leaving me thirsty for the profound wisdom of the Christian mystics and contemplatives, whom I followed ever since reading Evelyn Underhill's Mysticism in college. So like the prodigal son, I returned to my spiritual home and found refuge in an unlikely place. At a Trappist monastery some 20 miles from my home, having moved to Georgia when that lovely woman and I married, drawn to the abbey's silence and blessed by friendships with a number of the monks, I shyly took steps to formalize the relationship by making a profession as a lay Cistercian.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, thank you. But tending to prayer did not mean giving up writing. Early on, during the 5 years I spent in lay Cistercian formation, I heard a talk on writing by Anne Lamott, where she counseled her listeners to write the book you wish you could have read. So I did just that, and the publisher gave it a whimsical title, The Big Book of Christian Mysticism. When the book came out, I discovered I was not alone. Many people, both inside and outside the boundaries of the institutional church, hunger for that intimacy with God that the wisdom of the mystics point us to. The more I meet people who share my hunger for the God who comes to us in mystery and silence, the more convinced I am that contemplation is not just for monks or nuns, but the especially holy. It is for all of us. In the book, I call contemplation Christianity's best kept secret, and so I think I have at last found my vocation to help get the word out. I like your story.
Thank you.
You know, I think I was called to it, and I wanted to read it because it's so very similar to my own story. Recently, my husband and I had what I would consider probably a very similar car accident. Although it wasn't a brush with death, it could have been so much more serious than it was. And it does really sort of make you wonder, well, you know, why am I not dead? what am I still supposed to do? You know, what am I doing right? And, it does sort of make us scratch our head and think, well, could it all just be random? Or is there a bigger plan in store for us somewhere down the road? And, you know, maybe we just haven't figured it out yet.
Wow. Yeah, that sense of vocation or of purpose or of, you know, there's so many different ways you can approach it, but, you know, soul purpose, if you will. It really threw it into relief. It's so funny. You know, I wasn't even thinking about the accident as I was meditating before, you know, this interview began. But thank you for kind of taking me back to that, because it's amazing how, I guess, moments of crisis can really open up new possibilities for us, or as I described in that story, can kind of excavate old possibilities that maybe we had kind of turned our back on.
Well, and, you know, we become these hamsters on a wheel. You know, we get in these ruts and we get in these patterns of familiarity, and, you know, we figure there's always going to be enough time, you know, to get to all of these things. And I know I think those were some of the things that went through my mind too, was, you know, gee, I have really been procrastinating doing a lot of things. You know, what if I only had a year left? You know, what would I want to do with that year? And it actually sort of got me on the stick, and now I got a few projects, you know, in the hopper that, you know, I don't know if I would have started right now if it hadn't been for the accident very recently.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So
it's really interesting. My stepdaughter is quite ill, and so I live with that whole question, but not in my own skin, in the skin of someone I love. And it's quite challenging. I mean, I certainly wouldn't wish it on anyone. But I do think, it's interesting. You mentioned the fact that I now have a spiritual relationship with Trappist monks. You know, and there's a lot of kind of mythology around monks, you know, that they would sleep in their coffins and they would keep a skull on their desk and those kinds of things. And thankfully, the monks that I know are not nearly so macabre.
I didn't know that. I hadn't heard that about monks.
Oh, yeah, they dig their own graves. I mean, there's all these kinds of myths that are out there. But what I think they all stem from is kind of this idea that I think is part of the monastic tradition, that being aware of one's own mortality is seen as a doorway into wisdom.
Mm-hmm.
And not, again, not in a macabre sense, not in any way making a fetish out of it, but more just in a sense, I guess, in a sense of humility in the best sense of the word. Humility has often been co-opted by hierarchical and patriarchal interests to mean submission to external
mm-hmm.
authority. That's
mm-hmm.
not, you know, if you look at the etymology of humility, it actually comes from humus, which means the earth.
Mm.
So true humility is true earthiness. It's recognizing that we are creatures of clay, that we are, what is it, John O'Donohue, the Irish mystic, says, we are the earth in human form. And that's humility. And
that's beautiful.
Yes, it's really quite lovely. I mean, what I will tell people is that it's almost a self-forgetfulness. And the self that you're forgetting, of course, is the egoic self.
Mm-hmm.
To simply be present with our earthiness, our embodiedness, our clayness, if you will. But that also means being present to our limitations, being present to our finitude, you know, our mortality. And we live in a culture, so interesting listening to you speak about the so many challenges that we face today.
Just a short list.
I know. Just scratching the surface. Well, another just, you know, tiny one, but very significant, is how our culture both is frightened of death and then seeks to deny death or to kind of paste it over. I mean, just look at our funeral practices, that we take the body, we pump it full of chemicals, and then, you know, which, of course, again, is hostile to the earth. I mean, that is an act of aggression to the earth,
mm-hmm.
to embalm
mm-hmm.
a body. So
mm-hmm.
so we do that. Then what do? We put it in this horribly overpriced, largely non-biodegradable casket, and then we put that thing in a cement vault because we're
right.
so afraid of it.
Right.
You know?
And I remember, too, this book came out, I think, The Rule of Mores, and they talked about one of the reasons for, one of the reasons for sweeping the goddess away and patriarchy taking hold, I think it had to do with this very thing. It was man's desire, and I'm using that in the sense of, you know, mankind, humankind,
sure.
their desire to become immortal, to not have to face the cycles of life and death, which the goddess is all about, you know. She doesn't, you know, she's that cycle of life from womb to tomb. And, you know, that was part of what humankind wanted to resist.
You know, and that's interesting because certainly you can see that in institutional Christianity, where there is so much emphasis placed on kind of the eternality of the ego, and that the ego will be judged, you know, and good egos go to heaven and bad egos go to hell. And that, again, there might be, different sects within Christianity have different criterion, how they separate the sheep from the goats. But they all kind of fall into that, whether it's your, you know, you go to the, you participate in the seven sacraments, whether you have accepted Jesus as your Lord and Savior, whether you speak in tongues, you know, there's all these different criteria. But they all boil down to the same thing. It's what the Franciscan writer, and who I believe is a mystic, Richard Rohr, says. It's the reward-punishment paradigm. And what's ironic, you know, when you go into the mystical tradition, which is kind of this hidden tradition within the context of kind of the Christian culture, one of the things that you find is this almost lack of interest in that whole project. Kind of this idea that you know, that the experience of divine love is something that we are invited into right here and right now. And by being present in the present moment, it really renders this whole, again, like I say, very ego-driven question of what happens after we die basically irrelevant.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like, you know, the point is to enter into the transformational moment now. I loved the affirmations that you read. And was it the last one that I aspire to a higher consciousness?
Yeah.
And I thought, you know, I thought there was divine serendipity at work. Because, you know, to put it in a nutshell, the mystical path, and again, it's not, you know, Christian, Jewish, Muslim, pagan, Wiccan, I don't care what context. The heart of the mystical path is that quest for that inner alchemy, that inner transformation that happens right here and right now. It's not something that's delayed until after we die. It's not something that requires, you know, transcending the body or even worse, you know, rejecting the body. I mean, it's something that really belongs here in our embodiment, in our fleshiness.
Carl, and I'm as I'm hearing you speak, I'm you know, hearkening back to my days as a Catholic. I grew up in the Bible Belt of New Orleans, and you know, so I guess I consider myself a recovering Catholic, you know. And you know, I'm thinking, you know, none of this what you're talking about ever even came up in
sure.
my life as a Catholic or my life as a Christian. It was all about obedience, you know, just do as you're told. And, you know, you're not supposed to seek these, you know, these sorts of, you know, I guess I should say, you know, more sophisticated thought. You're just supposed to pay attention and do what the guy at the front of the church on the altar tells you to do. And, you know, just be a good little sheeple. And you're not really supposed to aspire or question very much. I mean, I didn't even hear about Christian mysticism until I became a goddess advocate and learned about Hildegard von Bingen. You know,
yeah,
I mean, it's not something,
yeah.
I think, I mean, do maybe a lot of Christians don't know about it themselves.
Oh, absolutely not. And, you know, it's so interesting, you know, kind of just to keep this kind of au courant. You know, when you look at yesterday, I mean, you know, as somebody who is engaged in the Christian community, yesterday was a very difficult day because here was the Supreme Court offering this tremendous good news to the gay and lesbian community. And, you know, and who were the party poopers? It was the Christians. You know, it was the Archbishop of New York, you know, all sorts of evangelical voices, Mike Huckabee. I mean, the Archbishop of Atlanta got involved. I mean, all of these people are out there just, you know, offering these really kind of alarmist, really not even very rational, but alarmist kind of fear-mongering in response to what I thought was actually a very conservative step forward in
right.
terms of gay and lesbian civil rights in our country. And it was very interesting to me because the one voice that I heard that was actually a voice of welcoming came from the presiding bishop of the Episcopal Church, who happens to be a woman. I thought that was really, really quite fascinating, that you had all of these male Christian voices out there speaking alarm and speaking very melodramatic,
mm-hmm,
you know,
mm-hmm.
and then the one kind of voice of reason
is the woman
in the midst of all that.
Isn't that why they you know, want to keep women out of the equation so they can, you know, keep the good old boys club going with all the crazy dogma?
It, I mean, you know, and I wouldn't give them the credit of even thinking it through to that level. I think it's I think subconsciously you're right. I think consciously there's so much fear of change.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, and kind of this anxiety, and it goes back to what divine image do we hold in our heart. And one of the things that I find so distressing as somebody who works within the Christian framework is that so many Christians are in the thrall of this obviously very patriarchal, hyper-masculine, very angry, very wrathful way of depicting the divine.
Right.
You know, and it's like, you know, I sit here and I say, hey, let's talk about divine love. And for a lot of folks, that's a non-starter because their whole idea is that God is really pissed off.
It's the authoritarian
angry
father, you know. I mean, yeah. It's, you know.
Well, and it's the abusive authoritarian father, too.
Yeah, and I mean, it's like, where does Jesus even fit into that equation? You know, it's like they've sort of forgotten Jesus. You know, I mean, at least it feels that way to me. And I keep saying over and over again, and whenever I have somebody on the show like you, I say, where are the progressive Christians? Why are they not standing up as loudly as these crazies, you know, who are hijacking their religion and giving it a bad name and making it irrelevant and driving people away? You know, isn't the other side standing up and saying, you know what, you don't represent me. You don't really represent our faith.
Well, you know, there are small little rivulets of hope. I mean, like I said, it was so nice to hear I think her name is Kathleen Jefferts Shorey, who's the presiding bishop of the Episcopal Church, to hear her voice yesterday. You know, I mean, 30 years ago, we wouldn't have even had that much. So that was encouraging. There is an organization, gosh, I can't even remember the name, which is embarrassing, but there is an organization of progressive Christians that is leaning on the media, because what the media does is the media turns to the far-right Christians to get their sound bites. So part of it is that the progressive Christians are ignored by the mainstream media.
The progressives in Congress are ignored, too. I mean, they've had a budget, and nobody wants to talk about it.
Well, and think about how on Halloween, so many media outlets want to turn to the most flamboyant, most kooky, practitioner of Wicca, and then that person is supposed to represent the entire goddess community. I mean, it's
absolutely
kind of the same dynamic. I mean, I, you know, certainly just on a personal level, I know a number of amazingly progressive, you know, persons who identify as Christians, and what they tend to be is they're so busy out there, you know, working with people on the streets, working with people who are HIV positive. I mean, they're out there doing the work of transformation. It's like, I don't have time to go talk to the media when they're going to just misquote me anyways. I hear what you're saying, and I think you're right. I think the progressive movement within Christianity has not yet found its voice. And that's a very important issue. And I think the gay and lesbian kind of community is very hopeful there, because, you know, so many gays and lesbians came up as Christians. And they have a Christian identity, but they're saying, hey, wait a minute, that old paradigm of that vengeful, wrathful, sexist, homophobic God just is a non-starter, and we really
right,
have to
exactly.
be beyond that.
Well, in thinking in these patriarchs, I'll call them, who were, you know, spouting the gloom and doom, you know, I'm sure the day before when the Supreme Court came out and gutted civil rights and voting rights, they didn't care about that either. And Christianity used to be about social justice, you know?
And I mean,
they don't care about that either. It just feels like it's all about, really, it feels like it's about a white male agenda, you know, and everybody
else
be damned.
What gets the press, unfortunately, and that is quite, quite tragic. And unfortunately, those people often are very, very well funded, and you know, so they have a lot of money at their disposal, and you know, and they've got you know, the media savvy and the media contacts. So the, you know, the challenge is great. The challenge is,
yeah,
is quite great. And I mean, you obviously know this, you know, as somebody who has stepped outside of the sphere of the institutional Christianity, you know, and is trying to live your life with integrity, you know, away from that context. You know, it's, I'll tell you, it's as crazy as it looks to you from the outside, it's even nuttier from the inside.
I bet. Well, speaking of some of these crazy patriarchs, let's talk about the new pope. Do you have much hope that anything is going to be different? You know, they're, you know, talking about, oh, he's taken the name Francis and all of this stuff. Do you think it's just smoke and mirrors?
Well, I think... I can't answer that briefly. Let's say, first of all, to put it briefly, I'd say he's about the best pope we could have hoped for.
Okay.
I think the reality is that if you look at where he stands in terms of many of the issues that certainly, you know, you and I think most of the community that listens to the show would hold dear, you'd probably still be very disappointed. You know, and yet even saying that, I think he has more environmental consciousness than so many of the bishops and cardinals. I mean, he's just made a couple of comments that have been very, very interesting. But, you know, we're certainly not, I don't think, again, I could be surprised, and I'm willing to be surprised in this way, but I don't expect to see any significant movement towards the ordination of women. You know, possibly removing enforced celibacy, which I think would be a step in the right direction. You know,
mm-hmm.
because when you think about it, what enforced celibacy does, I mean, the fear of the feminine is so great. It's like we don't even want our priests to be living in the same house as a woman.
They don't want them to be influenced by a woman.
They're going to be so tainted, you know. And so I think just removing the mandatory celibacy ban would be a tremendous step forward.
Yeah.
But the you know, so those, you know, those kind of gendered issues involving gender and involving sexuality. The reality is I think this guy is you know, he's a product of the incredible, you know, out of step realities that we see in
yeah.
the church. I mean, he's still a bishop that had been appointed by John Paul, and
right.
one of the realities is that John Paul tended to appoint bishops because he saw them as obedient, and Benedict continued that tradition. And
yeah, so
you
have a bunch of, so the pot they had to choose from were really, you know, they were all of the same ilk.
All of the eligible cardinals had, by that point, because when you realize, I mean, John Paul had been pope for, what, I think 27, 28 years, and then you have an additional 8 years of Benedict. So really a third of a century the church had been under these two incredibly, incredibly conservative, theologically, socially, and especially in terms of issues involving gender, you know, conservative leaders. So, you know, so in those issues, I think we've just got to be realistic about, you know, that Bergoglio or Francis, you know, is just, you know, if he is a revolutionary, wow, you know, it would be just totally amazing. Where I do think there is real hope is that I think his commitment to the poor really does represent a significant departure from these last two guys. I mean, especially Benedict XVI. I mean, Benedict XVI was all about pomp and all about circumstance and wearing the red shoes and the ermine
mm-hmm.
copes and, you know, really just, you know, he really wanted all of the trappings of that office. And this guy has totally eschewed all of that. And, I mean, symbolism is important. Symbolism
yeah.
does matter. It does send out a signal. And I think that the fact that on Monday, Thursday, he was willing to wash the feet, not only of a woman, which was a violation of canon law. I mean, this is the thing that a lot of people don't realize. He broke canon law when he washed the girl's foot. But not only was she a woman, but she was a Muslim woman. And I think it's such a tremendous message that he sent out there. And, you know, it's so funny because when you think about, you know, Jesus of Nazareth, I mean, Jesus of Nazareth broke the rules. And,
mm-hmm.
you know, was always in hot water. I mean, the Sabbath laws, for example. I mean, hey, we're hungry. You know, we're going to go pick some food, you know. I mean, he had a pragmatic approach to that kind of thing. Well, so here you have, you know, Pope Francis breaking the rules. So, you know, there is apparently a line in canon law somewhere that says that a priest should not wash the feet of a woman. Again, there's back that fear of the feminine that is so much part of the institutional church. And, you know, I want to draw that distinction between institutional Christianity and mystical Christianity, because I think it's an important distinction for people to bear in mind. But within the institutional church, you've got that fear of the feminine, and that's one of the many, many ways that it manifests, is this to me, totally ridiculous rule, but there it is on the books, that a priest should not wash the feet of a woman on Maundy Thursday. And here the Pope is just flagrantly ignoring that rule.
So, well, two things about the feminine. I'm wondering, has Francis come out and said anything about if he's going to stick by with the previous Pope, you know, had the nuns under such scrutiny, you know, saying that they were following these radical feminine ideas.
Yeah.
Has he actually said anything one way or another about that?
I have not followed it terribly closely. The one thing I have heard was a bit disappointing. What I got was that for now he's not changing any of the policy. So apparently everything that had been set into place under Benedict remains in place, where there is now a bishop that the Leadership Council of Women Religious is supposed to answer to, and those kinds of things. What I'm hoping is that he, because his priorities are so different, and frankly, because the American Women Religious, they are the Catholics who have been caring for the poor over the past 30 to 40 years.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and my hope would be that he would basically just, you know, I mean, he's obviously, he's not going to try to provoke the conservatives on too many issues, but I think that's something that he might just let that policy die on the vine. That's
just lay off.
Hope.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, and so it's like, which is not a perfect solution. I mean, obviously the perfect solution is that we come out and say, you know, we screwed up. The women in North America are really doing an exemplary work, and it would be great if more Catholics would be like them. I mean, that's what I would hope.
Right.
I'm sure what the women religious would hope too. But again, you know, recognizing just the limitations of who this man is, I don't expect anything that wonderful. What I would hope for is that he would just, like I say, you know, turn his priorities elsewhere. And I would think, given his commitment to the poor, that if anything, he would be very, very concerned that kind of ministry would be flourishing in North America, and the Catholics that are doing it are the women.
Right,
you know, that could not have escaped his notice. So
going back to the institutionalized church versus the feminine, what is it they're so afraid of? Seriously. I mean, do they think that suddenly we will turn them in, we will become the oppressors and do to them what they've done to us for thousands of years? Or, you know, they're going to get vinyl, they're going to get probes up there or something or other. I mean, what is it? Why are they so afraid of women?
Well, the first thing, I don't know that it's conscious with the individual leaders, or certainly with the zeitgeist of the church as a whole. I think it's a profoundly repressed and probably deeply submerged kind of anxiety that you have going on there. I mean, if I wanted to get all Freudian on you, I'd say it's castration anxiety. But I'm not particularly a Freudian, so I'm not going to go down that road. But I guess what I would say is that, you know, I think it does go back to the image of God. And because the predominant image of God within the institutional church is this hyper-masculine, hyper-angry, abusive father figure, I think there really is kind of this deep-seated fear of pissing off the angry God. And you and I can sit there and say, well, that just makes no sense whatsoever. But we're not in the thrall of that kind of, I think it is kind of a psychic enslavement. And I think it probably, well, you know, where did it come from? Well, probably it came from the Roman Empire. I mean, we need to remember that the Catholic Church, the hierarchy of the Catholic Church, essentially took over the political model of the Roman Empire and replicated it within the church. And that, you know, that, you know, is basically how this organization has run itself for, what, 1700 or 1800 of its 2000 years. And you know, and we can look at it, and we can see how obviously it is in crisis in terms of how people are just abandoning the church. I mean, that's why I giggled when you described yourself as a recovering Catholic. I mean, frankly, there are almost as many recovering Catholics in North America today as there are practicing Catholics. And, you know, I mean, that's a crisis. And it's not just among Catholics. I mean, it's funny because 30 or 40 years ago, the liberal Christian churches started losing members, mainly because they were all either becoming Buddhists or pagans. But now even the conservative churches are losing members. You know, young people are just not interested in worshiping the angry, abusive Father God anymore, which I think is tremendously good news. But, of course, that's very frightening to the churches.
Well, and I mean, and let's face it, I mean, I know this is going to sound horribly heretical, but who would choose this God for their God anyway? The guy's a sociopath. You know, you wouldn't want him, you know, you wouldn't want him for a neighbor, you wouldn't want him for a husband, you wouldn't want him for a father, you would be scared shitless of him. So, you know, he's like the drunk father. You know, you come home and you're on walking on eggshells because you never know what you're going to find when you open the door. You know, that's sort of what it reminds me of. It's almost masochistic.
It's profoundly masochistic.
Yeah, it's masochistic to want to be a part of it, quite frankly. It feels unhealthy.
Well, I think really the only kind of way I can make sense of it is the Stockholm Syndrome. And I think that, you know, that institutional Christianity represents the Stockholm Syndrome written on kind of this global scale, where this idea that, you know, that the church has for so long presented such an angry, fear-based image of God.
Mm-hmm.
And people are frightened by that image, but then they learn to identify with that image.
Right.
And, you know, and I mean, and there is, you know, there is language in the New Testament about how God is love. I read that from a contemplative perspective, and I say, well, wait a minute. This shows how the abusive image of God is a lie.
Mm-hmm.
But I think, frankly, within the institutional church, there's kind of, it's almost like George Orwell, you know, and the whole thing, you know, well, I can't remember all the ones in 1984, but it's like, you know, freedom is servitude, and, you know, how language was kind of turned on itself within the totalitarian state. I think you see the same dynamic within Christianity where, in again, kind of operating subconsciously, but within the mind of the institutional Christian, the angry God, that's what they think love is.
So it becomes a very perverted idea
of love.
What if it's just a scam on the masses? Because if you got, so you have it at the front of the church, this poor dying Jesus, so it's all about suffering, it's all about sacrifice, so that sends you the message, don't expect to have happiness in your life, just sort of suck up everything.
And be a martyr.
It, you know, to sort of, you know, control the masses and not, you know, getting them to expect too much, while maybe the people that are in the institutionalized church, it's, you know, nudge, nudge, wink, wink, boy, we sure got them where we want them. You know, they keep giving us their money, you know, they do what we say, and all the while, you know, we're going to fiddle about with little boys and wear red shoes and have all the money in the world, and, you know, screw them, those stupid sheeple, they're duped.
you know,
I know that's horrible, but...
Well, I hear that cynicism, but the only thing I would say is, and there may be some people who really do have that kind of cynical, manipulative approach, and you know, my heart just goes out to how, what their soul must really be like if they really, in good faith, operate that way. But what I think is, just, and based on my experience, I have no science to back this up, so just take this with all appropriate grains of salt, just based on my own experience, is that I think that the dupe, that even the dupers are duped. And it's interesting because this would be my argument, you know, again, speaking as a man, biologically man, about, you know, kind of the whole concept of patriarchy, you know, that clearly, you know, women suffer the most under patriarchy. But patriarchy also, men also pay a price too.
Mm-hmm,
the men do get do get the experience of gender privilege. I'm not trying to deny that gender privilege is a reality within kind of the patriarchal world. But there's also the price of, you know, most men are emotionally constipated. You know, men live in terror of other men, you know, beginning with their fathers, but then their bosses and, you know, any kind of man who has power over them. You know, big brothers terrorize younger brothers. In the military, let's not even go there, but the amount of violence and you know. This is the reality, is that that patriarchy hurts everybody. It doesn't just hurt women.
Right. No, I know that. I don't deny that at all.
And I think that the same dynamic is at work in the church, that the bishops and the priests do have privileges within the church, but they also pay a tremendous price as well. And I think not the least of which is their own authenticity. You know, I mean, I have some friends who do ministry with women who have, you know, had affairs and in many cases had children on the hands of priests. And, you know, and it's kind of blood-curdling how widespread that is, you know. And, of course, you know, the sexual abuse of children, which is so horrific, gets much more attention.
Yeah.
But the fact that the women are at the age of consent when they have affairs with the priest does not in any way take away the amount of pain that they ultimately suffer, and how they get humiliated by the church and get treated badly when they end up having a child, you know, and you know, so the church wants to write them a check so they go away, basically. I mean,
right.
You know, so, you know, and the thing that we have to keep in mind is, well, did the priests that slept with these women, are they all monsters? Well, I mean, we could argue that obviously they were outside of their integrity and unethical. I mean, I think that's obvious. But I also think that they're tortured men who, in their hearts of hearts, really would like to be able to express their sexuality in healthy ways, and it's been
denied.
Well,
you said before about the celibacy. I mean, it feels like the patriarchy is all about turning what is natural off, turning that switch off, whether it be women or sexuality, whatever it is. It's like they want to turn, I mean, it's like, you know, Athena being born from Zeus's head. You know, the patriarchy comes along and what is the rules no longer apply. You know, they make new rules.
and it's interesting, born from the head. It's not like a rejection of the body. It's very cognitive. It's very cerebral.
Yeah.
You know, and that's interesting that you should say that, because I think that at least speaking within Christianity, I think that the culprit there is the patriarchal Greek dualism. You know, that Judaism historically was a much more embodied expression of faith. And that's not to say Judaism doesn't have its problems with patriarchy, but compared to the dualism that you find in the Greek world, you know, patriarchal Greek, I'm not talking about matrifocal Greek, but the patriarchal Greek world, what you see with Plato, with Aristotle, with Plotinus, you know, with these philosophers who all, you know, they're the ones who just came up with this idea that the body was evil, you know, and that the bodies needed to be shunned, and that the only way to truly be, you know, to truly be pure was to be pure spirit. And you know, and Christianity took this and ran with it, and we are still paying the price, you know.
Well, and you wonder if there was, you know, was it, did they really believe to be released from the body would be a good thing, or were they just misogynists, you know?
Well,
and it was convenient.
I think the answer is yes, because I think that the fear of the body and the fear of the feminine go hand in hand.
Yeah. Well, it's like the people who want women to wear burqas, you know. Let's not control ourselves. Let's oppress them because we can't control ourselves. You know, they're the bad ones that have to be hidden underneath the black cloth and the steaming sun.
Because God forbid that we actually get turned on, you know, and God forbid that, you know, and then it gets into property issues. You know, I don't want another man being turned on by my woman because my woman is my property, and all that kind of craziness. And then, that's the dynamic that's at play. And again, it's often subconscious. It's like the person that's in the thrall of it has no idea it's going on, you know.
But yet they'll take an 11-year-old girl as a wife. Oh, I mean, don't even get me started. We could go down so many avenues here. But Carl, it's been great. But we haven't even gotten to Julian yet.
Well, and I know we don't have a lot of time, unfortunately. Maybe I'll have to come back some other time. But I think so.
But let's at least touch on it a little bit. I mean, I did the same thing last week with Sheeta, who we were supposed to talk about Anahita, the Persian goddess. But I started off by asking her what she thought about the elections in Iran, and we talked about politics for 30 minutes, and we had like 5 minutes on Anahita. Let's talk a little bit about Julian and the Christian mystics. Did they tend to be equally men and women, or what was the gender?
Well, first of all, let's be realistic. That Christianity as a religion has, you know, always, I mean, I suppose we can make an argument that there are seeds of hope today. But for most of its history, Christianity has always been a religion that has existed and operated within a patriarchal context. So even the mystical Christians, there's plenty to deconstruct with them, and you can find, you know, plenty of evidence within even Julian of Norwich or Hildegard of Bingen or, you know, some of these amazing figures, and you can say, but wait a minute, you know, I see so much kind of internalized sexism in their writing, and, you know, and those kinds of, yes, it's there, and I think we just have to, and we have to acknowledge that there is not any kind of a pure non-sexist strain within Christianity. If you're looking for that, I'm sorry, I don't think it exists.
Yeah.
That I think Christians today can say, well, maybe that's something that we need to, you know, try to envision. What would it mean to envision and to articulate a post-patriarchal Christianity? I think that's a beautiful question. But, you know, obviously my focus has been on history. It's almost like the conversation we had about the Pope, that, you know, the Pope is imperfect, but we can celebrate some hopeful signs within who he is. And this is what I see within the mystical tradition within Christianity, is that the mystical tradition has been where women historically have had at least some sort of a voice. Certainly they've never had, you know, I mean, up until our lifetime, when churches, the Protestant churches began to ordain women, and obviously the Orthodox and Catholic churches still don't, and conservative Protestants still don't, but at least there's been some movement in that time. But you look at Hildegard of Bingen and you look at Julian of Norwich, for example, they're the 12th and 14th century, respectively, when women had, you know, I mean, women in Europe at that time were not much better than women in, you know, in fundamentalist Muslim cultures are today, you know.
Yeah, I mean,
weren't they pretty
much chattel? I mean,
they were understood it to be the property of first their fathers and then their husbands, you know, those kinds of things. And you know, and here Hildegard comes along, you mentioned her, you know, and Hildegard asserts her own voice. And she asserts it by saying, I've received visions, and my visions give me authority. And she was savvy enough to basically get the Pope on her side. And once, you know, I mean, it's like once the biggest gorilla in the room likes you, all the other gorillas are going to respect you. That's, you know, and that's what she did. I know it was brilliant. And then, you know, generations of later women mystics really stand on Hildegard's shoulders. So we owe an immense debt of gratitude to Hildegard. Julian, we don't know a whole lot about her life story, but we do know that when she was 30 years old, she was very sick, and during her illness, she had a series of visions, and then she wrote about those visions. And again, that's a radical act. I mean, we think, you know, yeah, you want to write, you know, you grab a computer, you grab an iPad, you know, you go to the drugstore and you buy a notebook, and you start writing. I mean, writing would have been expensive in her day. Paper would have been expensive. Ink would have been tremendously difficult to come by. So it was certainly, you know, a tremendous act of assertion of her own voice to actually write. Julian is the first woman to write a book in the English language.
Wow.
The 1300s. So she really deserves our respect, you know, just for that reason alone. But then, you know, and her visions cover a lot of terrain. But one of the things, you know, even just a casual reading of her book, it becomes very obvious that she is just totally, you know, not interested in, in that abusive patriarchal God figure. That even though she, for the most part, she uses traditional masculine, you know, God is our father, God is the king, so forth. She uses that language. That's the language she grew up with. It's the only language she knew. But then she deconstructs from within. And one of the things is she says, I saw no wrath in God. A very revolutionary statement. It's interesting because the manuscripts, all the early manuscripts we have of Julian come from convents. And some scholars think that her manuscripts were probably surreptitiously passed from convent to convent, and the nuns basically tried to keep it out of the hands of the bishops because they knew what she was saying was so radical that it could have been seen as heretical or as seditious.
Well,
and
almost,
as I'm sorry.
Go ahead, I'm sorry.
I was going to say, and just this last point, and then I want to hear your thought. And then, you know, what truly is just so wonderful about Julian was that she did dare to speak about God. And again, using God, she never used the word goddess. That word just would not have been part of her vocabulary. But God as mother. She says, she very bluntly says, as truly as God is our father, so is God our mother. And then she just goes on to you know, to just excavate this idea that motherhood is an appropriate category for approaching the divine mystery. And, you know, and I think that this is something that obviously people in the goddess community can really claim that and say, you know, that this is just evidence of a Christian who really kind of could think for herself, you know, 650 years ago. And with even working within the Christian world, what I see there is a liberation from the idea that God must be under the thrall of an exclusive masculine understanding of the divine.
I can see where you would say all of that, but I wonder, when she says God is mother, is that not exactly the same thing as Zeus birthing Athena from his head? You know, taking the female as life giver out of the equation.
I'll be honest with you, I'd kind of have to ponder that. I think that you could certainly, you know, it's almost like, how do you want to read that? I mean,
I
guess
what
I'm hearing you say
is
this actually an enforcing of patriarchy?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, certainly Julian does not take patriarchy on the way that women within the last 30 to 50, maybe 100 years have taken it on. That is not part of her vocabulary or her language.
But for her time, she was radical.
I guess what I'm saying is that for her time, I think that I don't think anybody who would have read Julian in the 1400s would have said, oh, this is just another, you know, Athena and Zeus thing. I think it would have been
seen as
a profoundly radical statement.
Well, the other thing it made me think about, too, you know, when you were talking about her having the visions, I wonder if she was lucky that they didn't say she was psychotic, because, you know, men can have visions of God, but, you know, can women? I mean, after all, if women can't be called, you know, to the priesthood, can women actually have visions of God, or is it just their hallucinations, you know?
And that would actually be a relatively benign fate, would be just for them to dismiss her as like you say, as disturbed. What I think would be the greater risk is that she would be accused of heresy.
Or burned at the stake, or something.
And burned it, exactly. There were mystics who were burned at the stake, and they tended to be the women. You know, the men would be denounced as heretics, and they would lose their teaching position. But the women paid with their lives. I mean, that was that was the reality of that world. So for a woman like Julian or Hildegard of Bingen, you know, or Teresa of Avila, a couple of centuries later, for them even to write their, and like I say, from our perspective, their flawed and imperfect theology was still a tremendous act of courage. And in that courage, what I think we can see is we can see the glimmers of a willingness to step outside of the prison of the patriarchal mind.
Right.
And to say, there are other ways to envision the divine.
Yeah, it's something to build on, you know. It's not perfect, but it's something to build on, and it gives other people permission to think outside the box.
And we've, you know, back to humility, you know, even those of us who try so hard to maintain a high level of consciousness and to live compassionately and creatively and with a commitment to justice, today, in the year 2013, you know, somebody 1,000 years from now will look back at us and say, oh, those poor, pitiful people. You know, even
I sure hope so.
You know,
I hope we're going to evolve and we will look pitiful. You know,
that we don't just kill the planet first. I mean, back to the litany that you spoke at the beginning of the hour. But you know, but assuming that we somehow manage not to kill the planet, and that we somehow can manage to shake off, you know, the horrors of the injustice that has been part of our society for so long, that would be my hope. Is that, you know, even those of us who strive so hard to be enlightened beings today, 500 years from now, we would be just, you know, they'll look back and say, poor things, they were doing the best they could.
We were cavemen and women.
You know, so, you know, and I think maybe, you know, this is something that I think all of us need to ponder, is that, you know, it is so important for us to strive for justice and to strive to live compassionately and to live fearlessly and you know, to live in relationship with the earth and in healthy relationship with one another, and also with that sense of humility that, guess what, we're still gonna make mistakes. We're still gonna get it wrong some of the time. And that doesn't mean we're failures, but it does mean that we need to continually pick ourselves up and to say, you know, how can, you know, each day, it's back, almost back to your thing about the car accident and recognizing, you know, yes, we are finite beings. What can I do today to be as faithful as possible to the call of compassion and of justice and, you know, what I would call the divine mystery, what you would call the goddess. So.
Well, and also, too, one of the things that you said in your bio that I really related to as well was you gave yourself permission not to be perfect. You know, and that I actually was just writing about that. I'm in the process of writing a book, and I was, you know, part of it was, you know, encouraging people to just get out there, even if they have to figure it out along the way, on the job training.
Yeah.
Don't not follow your calling because you know you feel like you won't be perfect. So what? You know, who among us is perfect? Just
do.
Yeah.
It's so much better to make a mistake, and then when you've realized that you've made the mistake, say, okay, now what can I do to fix it? What can I do to clean it up? But if we're doing nothing at all, frankly, we're ceding power to those who have taken power and are abusing it. And that's what I think. That's the alternative that we really need to avoid. So.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, because we are living in a tough time. I mean, you know, going back to that ideal of Ma'at that you sort of singled out, I aspire to higher consciousness. You know, it's really hard to not slip into the gutter with the bullies. You know, it's really hard to take the high road when, you know, when the powers that be who, you know, are busy, you know, going about their business oppressing other people. You know, it really, you get to the point where you want to just fight back, but yet you don't want to become what they are. So it's a struggle.
That, I think that's the perennial temptation of the revolutionary, is that we are tempted to become the mirror image of that which we fight. And you know, and it's you know, out of the best of intentions, you know, to take a stand for liberation, to take a stand on behalf of those who are oppressed. You know, and then, you know, I mean, look at what happened in Russia and in China. You know, I suppose you could even argue the United States, you know, which began as a revolutionary movement and, you know, and then in many ways became very, very repressive. So you're right, you know, and I think that this is, you know, even, you know, religious or spiritual reform movements have to be very, very conscious that, you know, I do not want to become the mirror image of that which I am. You know, the old thing about, you know, that when Christianity, you know, moved into Europe and it turned the indigenous spiritualities into its demons, You know, and I think that people who choose to move beyond Christianity today need to be very careful not to just have kind of a facile demonization of Christianity. I mean, fight injustice, you know, resist injustice. Better yet, work for justice. Put your energy in the bad direction. You know,
right.
But don't demonize the ones whom you've left behind. I just think that eventually will bite you in the butt.
Yeah.
And it's something I think we all have to be very, very conscious of.
Good point, Carl. Verinda has not actually called in yet, surprisingly. Okay. I should have synced up our clocks with her today. But you also mentioned Bernard of Clairvaux. So was he a Christian mystic as well?
Yeah.
Of the motherhood of Christ?
Certainly not as... certainly not as revolutionary as Julian was or as Hildegard. And it's interesting, you know, Bernard is a very kind of complex figure too. To air his dirty laundry, he was a backer of the Second Crusade. And how can anything good come out of that? But he was also a Hildegard of Bingen's advocate, and he was the one who actually advocated on her behalf to the Pope.
Uh-huh.
And when she got the papal seal of approval, like I said, then she, it was basically, she had a license to, you know, to just be Hildegard. And so Bernard was one of her early advocates and early, you know, kind of sponsors in that respect. So he's a very complex figure and very, very, you can see a lot of, you know, neat things about him and a lot of really kind of tragic things about him. He was very, you know, again, you know, that whole dualism, that fear of the body is very, very evident in his personal behavior. You know, he would fasting and you know, discipline and those kinds of things that we would look at today and we would say that's just psychologically unhealthy. You know,
well,
but,
it
and
makes
that,
me think of the Opus Dei. You know, you saw in, you know, how they would make suffer, you know, the body,
oh, yeah,
you know, like the body
fetish.
Is the suffering, you know.
Mm-hmm. And that there's something redemptive in causing, in self-inflicted suffering. You know, the horsehair shirt and the whip and the cinculum and all those kinds of things, you know. And I think we can rightly reject those as psychologically unhealthy. And yet in that world, they did not have that sense of psychological self-awareness, and again, they were operating with that kind of patriarchal Greek idea that the body was somehow the enemy.
Right.
And, I mean, this is the thing, is that I think wherever you see the fear of the feminine, it seems to be linked with the fear of nature and the fear of the body.
Yeah,
somehow,
it's all connected.
Those three tend to kind of walk hand in hand. So those are just some of the things that we have to be real about, you know, who Bernard was. On the positive side, Bernard, and he, like I say, he was a contemporary of Hildegard of Bingen, so he's about 200 years before Julian.
Yeah.
But Bernard also wrote about encountering the kind of the quality of motherhood. Now, he wrote about it specifically in terms of Christ, kind of seeing Christ and as the nurturing mother. It's interesting. You've really given me a lot to think about with the whole kind of Athena question. I mean, that's really a very, very, very rich and very important question. You know, the question that when this kind of discourse emerges, is it actually enforcing the patriarchy, or is it a voice for liberation? You know, and I think that maybe the simplest way to say is, well, it's probably a little bit of both.
Possibly.
You know, and that there could really be, ways in which it's, you know, it's almost like that kind of language is almost like an escape valve, you know, in which, you know, kind of some of the inner contradictions of kind of the patriarchal consciousness can kind of, you know, let off.
Well, and how can we possibly really be in the head of someone, you know, from the 13th century, you know? I mean,
that's
it's impossible to know what they were really thinking, and they might not even have been aware enough to even think these thoughts, you know?
What's like what I'm saying today, that I think the church today is so much kind of subconsciously in the thrall of its own sexism. You know, certainly if that's true today, how much more so would it have been true 600 or 800 years ago?
Right.
So,
well, Carl,
you know,
we're going to have to wrap it up, but
okay.
I do invite you to come back. It's been
lovely.
Fun chatting with you. I'm sure we can find other things to talk about. We didn't even really talk about your books very much, but let
uh-huh.
me mention them again in case listeners would like to you know, follow your work a little bit more.
Mm-hmm.
Carl has written The Big Book of Christian Mysticism and The Lion, the Mouse, and the Dawn Treader. His new book, Answering the Contemplative Call. And his website is Carl, with a C, carlmccolman.com. Well, anything else you'd like to close with, Carl, as we have to wrap up tonight? Maybe something, you know, I failed to ask or thought you'd like to leave listeners with?
No, well, it's just been a great conversation. Thank you so much. I mean, so, you know, so much of the work I do tends to be within the institutional church, which, as you can imagine, that means that I tend to have a very different conversation. So it's kind of a delight to be in this context where we can have this kind of conversation. So I really appreciate that. And I think the thing that I would say, you know, is that, you know, certainly, you know, Christian mysticism, you know, some people may just not be interested at all because they've really, you know, separated themselves from Christianity, and that's fine. But I think that wherever anybody is in any of the world's wisdom traditions, the whole idea of mysticism, the idea that my spiritual experience can really be anchored in my own experience and doesn't have to be shaped by what other people tell me is normative for their
mm-hmm.
experience, is such an important dynamic that you know, I think, you know, Christian, Jewish, Buddhist, Muslim, Hindu, pagan, shamanistic, atheist for that matter, I don't care what label you wear, you know, just you know, trust your own body, trust your own wisdom and your own intuition, and that doesn't mean that we shouldn't be in conversation with one another and that we shouldn't, you know, draw from the wisdom of those who have come before us, but also kind of like what we've been doing tonight, don't be afraid to question and don't be afraid to criticize.
Right.
I think that's all just so important and such an important part of the journey. So I guess that would be my final thought. So.
Well said. Well, thank you very much. And our good thoughts and prayers go out to your daughter. I didn't get a chance to ask about her, but I hope she's doing better.
Yeah, I mean, obviously we're rescheduled from last time, and we're, yeah, much, much better than before. Thank you so much.
Good. Good. Well, Carl, let's keep in touch, and if you have an idea for another show, please get in touch with me. I'll be happy to have you back again.
Absolutely. All right.
All right. Good
Take
night.
Care. Bye-bye now.
Bye-bye. Well, we are crossing the threshold into the second part of the show, and very soon we will have Verinda Pooja chatting with us. But first, a word from Joe Carson in Dancing with Gaia.
The psychic state of the collective unconscious, which is that consciousness of the planet. It's called the chthonic mind, the mind of the earth.
Our ancestors understood that the animal and divine were all connected. They were together. That there wasn't a separation. And that's what we are trying to return to, is that sense that our animal nature is divine. It doesn't get in the way of the divine. It gets us closer to it.
What's your idea of being fully alive as a human being? Because that's what's really spiritual. Write it down. Start writing your own Bible if you want.
That's the sacred. And by that, I just mean sweaty, fun, happy sex.
Well, that was a little excerpt from the trailer for the DVD Dancing with Gaia, a feature documentary about earth energy, sacred sexuality, and return of the goddess as Gaia. It's a great film that goes deep into the connections between these important topics, and the DVD comes packaged with a 45-page mini book that expands on the material in the film, and you can get it at dancingwithgaia.com. Interesting, is it, considering our conversation about how the body you know, how the body within Christianity and the patriarchal religions, the body is always taboo, the body is always dirty and unclean. But of course, not when you're talking about the mother. Well, I am going to say good evening to Verinda. Hi, Verinda. Welcome to the show.
Good evening. It is such a pleasure to join you here, Karen.
Oh, well, you know what?
Thank you. I have been
looking forward to chatting with you all day. I think we have such an interesting topic, you know, to chat about tonight. But before we actually jump into that, let me tell listeners a little bit about you, Verinda, so they have a sense of, you know, who you are and what your perspective is. Let's see, Verinda says at an early age she aspired to meet a living saint, one who embodied compassion and kindness. Her aspiration was fulfilled by the opportunity to study and live in close proximity with three saints. In 1979, Verinda had the opportunity to enter a monastic life of service in the Vedic tradition at the Yoga Research Foundation in Miami, Florida. Her guru soon encouraged her to teach at Patanjali's mystic psychology. To teach on Patanjali's mystic psychology and other scriptures of India. She immersed herself in the study of Samkhya and Vedic classics, with a particular interest in their application to modern everyday life while raising her two children at the ashram. During this time, she also collaborated with H.H. Swami Lalitanada in the developing stages of Lalita Jyoti Anathalia, I know I'm murdering these names, a girls' orphanage that also welcomes abandoned mothers and women, and it was located in Haryana, India. In 2002, she started on a pilgrimage through a few distinguished Vedic communities in upstate New York, moved by the spiritual transformations she had experienced and with immense gratitude to her beloved teachers. In 2005, she returned to Florida and was blessed with darshan of the goddess-inspired mother, spiritual and political reformer H.H. Maha Mandaleshwara Mai Yoga Shakti, who initiated her in the Vedic goddess tradition, establishing Verinda deeper in the goddess tradition and gave her the new name, Jamuna Shakti. Meeting my yoga Shakti fulfilled Verinda's aspiration to meet an embodiment of goddess who lives alone. Verinda believes that studying and learning while in the service of goddess and God takes being's personal transformation to the ultimate mystical levels of experience. Quite an interesting life there, Verinda. You remind me of myself, actually, on the first pilgrimage I made to Greece many, many years ago. It was my goal to see an apparition of goddess. And the closest I came was experiencing nature in such an intimate way from my bedroom window that I honestly felt like it was a gift from the goddess. There was an intimacy about it. It's hard to language it. But I still had that tiny bit of disappointment that, gee, I didn't see the face of goddess, you know, shining over my bed or in a sacred grove or something.
Yes. I can relate to that feeling, yes. Very, very interesting what you,
well, you know,
what you share about yourself, yeah.
Well, you know, here in L.A., I did have the pleasure of meeting Amachi, and I thought about her a lot today as I knew we were going to chat tonight, and that experience took me quite by surprise. You know, I was not really a follower. Some of my friends were followers of hers, and they said, "Oh, you have to come and see her and hear her," and it was a really interesting experience because, I mean, you know, there are thousands of people that gather to see Amma. You know, she's the hugging saint, they call her. I mean, some people consider her the embodiment of the goddess as well, and it was so interesting the way the room parted when she entered the room. It just so happened that I was on the, I was sort of like on the edge of the center of the room as it parted so that she could walk through. And as she came through, I was actually one of the ones she touched. And I was shocked because the electrical bolts of lightning, it sort of felt like, that just sort of shot through my body. Because, you know, I went there with no expectation. I did not know much about her. There was no anticipation. I was just there as a casual observer. And when she touched me and those feelings went through my body, she sure got my attention. It felt like there was really something going on with that woman.
Yes, I agree with you. Nothing quite ever prepares us for the experience of coming face to face with a mystic personality, with the goddess personality in a living human being. We have many concepts, and we live by those concepts. I have had very beloved conversations and interactions with a woman who is very close to Amachi. And because of my experience with two other women who embody goddess, I wonder to what extent in our Western mind constructs, we tend to believe that an embodiment of goddess, if one woman is embodies goddess, that's it. There are no other women who embody goddess. The Western mind in us immediately starts comparing. Isn't it?
If you're a monotheist, you might think like that, though, you know. But if you're a polytheist and you think goddess can be in more than one face, then maybe it's not such a hard thing to believe that goddess could be in all three.
Right, exactly. But beyond the concept of theory, in practice, what I have encountered even among groups of academics who swear that they are very open-minded, is that there is a lot of suspicion and skepticism about anyone encountering a woman embodiment of goddess, especially if they don't attain certain level of fame, because we become easily impressed by fame, power, or recognition, you know.
So you're saying if they weren't famous, they doubted that they were really the embodiment of goddess?
Right, that's what it is. A part of me wonders, if Amachi were not that famous, would so many people have the, or those that are not touched by her, like you were, you were touched in a way that was more than physical, in a psychic way, right?
Right,
from
right,
what
right.
I hear you, right. But most others who may just feel drawn to the mass appeal of her fame are missing something deeper that is even more lasting than what woman embodiment of goddess projects in a visit of thousands and thousands of people.
Right. Yeah, I think what you're saying is, you know, some people may jump on the bandwagon and think she's something special just by virtue of her popularity, not by her words, or maybe, however else you're moved. Because, you know, I have to tell you, before that experience, I'd never had anything like that with anyone before. I mean, it was hard to even language because, nobody that I knew had ever shared with me, well, gee, you know, when I, you know, was in the presence of so-and-so and she touched me, wow, you know. It was quite an unusual experience, but it felt like to me that there was something really happening there, you know, that she's plugged into something, you know.
Yes. It is commonly recognized from Vedic sages or enlightened beings in the Indic tradition that the interrelation between this divine beings and another person, be it a devotee or someone like in your situation, you were spiritually receptive and ready, that the readiness and receptivity of the devotee or the other person is a path or includes the experiences and disciplines and merits and accumulated positive karmas of many previous lives. So in this way, your experience confirms that your spiritual path has been ongoing, you have been cultivating it for many lives. It is not just perhaps it contains a depth. You know, there are, what I mean is that there are many more reasons than the causal effect of her touching you and you feeling this bolt of energy. From previous lives, she may have been your mother, your dearest daughter, your teacher before. The karmic connections between you and her may go back many lives, not just at face value, right?
So that experience I had with her, is that unusual? Or is it something typical of, I don't know, maybe people who are better versed in that tradition? I mean, is that some sort of a feeling that people expect to have, or is it more unusual?
I wouldn't say it's a matter of usual or unusual. I would consider that you're being ready and ripe for the karmic experience for a psychic experience by her touch. In the past, from my readings of the life of saints, what comes to mind was the experience of Swami Vivekananda one day when Ramakrishna Paramhamsa, who was to become his spiritual guide, preceptor, and guru, touched him in the chest, and Vivekananda went into very high samadhi. It was more than a jolt or perception of awareness. It was a perception that took him outside of normal consciousness for perhaps more than 1 hour, certain period of time that others who were witnesses were able to write about this. So, and I believe that it all is connected with psychic abilities of different stages. From what I experienced in my life, the spiritual mystics with whom I lived in close contact or in daily contact, let's say, because of the proximity of seeing them daily, they were not ready to give me a vault of energy every day, or let's say, or even frequently. It did happen over a long period of time that I became aware of a gradual, subtle transformation was beyond my limited human capacity.
Right.
And of course, I attribute that to their grace and influence.
Okay.
But there are other mystics and saints who do not see the need to externalize psychic abilities in ways that would be dramatic or in ways that our mind could discern and describe them in empirical terms.
Well, let me ask you about there was this one. God, I don't know the right terminology, so forgive me. I'm going to say he was a guru because I don't know that much about this tradition to probably use the right title. But I saw a show about him once. His name was Sai Baba, and I believe he was supposed to actually manifest things in his hand from nothing. What is that about? I mean, was that actually something that was really possible, or was, I hate to use the word scam, was that just a trick?
Well, this is the danger of being impressed by psychic ability in a way that that takes us away from the marvels of the even more extraordinary miracles that are happening before our very eyes every day, with when the sun rises, every night when the brightest day turns into the darkest night. These are extraordinary psychic experiences. Sunrise and sunset is a psychic experience. There are many more psychic experiences that are amazing within us. If we only had the patience to sit still and be in awe. I do not know much about Sai Baba. I have heard about some about his fame and psychic abilities. And again, I believe that, or it's my opinion, that someone who uses magic to draw attention is not a seriously evolved mystic or saint, is someone who is caught in the
ego,
right? Well, let me not say ego, because that's another word that I'm writing about. The difference precisely, you put me in a whole different frame of mind by saying ego. In our Western world, and I was born and raised as a Western person, so I'm not being critical of others, but of my upbringing and my cultural background also. But in the Western world, the word ego is used in psychology and philosophy to refer to the other, but very seldom for introspection and self-improvement. And in Eastern tradition, the analysis of ego is meant for introspection, visharana, deep meditation and profound transformation of oneself, not of trying to change the other, but trying to change oneself.
Right.
So,
right.
But yeah, right. I wanted to make that point before I forget that. That's not the point of my judging or our conversation about Sai Baba. I believe it's in the sense of what is very practical, that even when anyone reads the Patanjali Sutras, which are a treatise on how to purify the body and mind, or prepare the human body and mind vessel and intellect and the chakras and our psychophysical experience of life and phenomenological experience of existence, how to prepare it to be the best vessel to get across to the other side of the ocean of afflictions and pain, because there is pain in life. This is the premise. It's not only the premise in Buddhism, it's the premise in Sankhya, the Sankhya of Patanjali, the dualistic philosophy, the dualistic aspect of Vedanta. Vedanta is non-duality, and the Sankhya is the dualistic aspect of the philosophy, which most people consider or call Hinduism. Hinduism is the popular religion, but Samkhya philosophy or dualistic philosophy and non-dualistic are the ontological aspects of this background. However, when an individual in the process of mystic and spiritual disciplines, a life of mysticism and spiritual disciplines, throughout many embodiments and practices in monastic tradition as well as the practices inside of married life or professional life or whatever previous life experiences. Throughout these disciplines in daily life, meditation, sacrifices, introspection, control of egoistic emotions, so throughout these rigorous practices, different yogis, different individuals reach different levels of samadhis and different levels of unfoldment of higher chakras or unfoldment of lower chakras, depending on the particular perfection of the practice, right?
Right. Yeah.
And different individuals are caught or end alive. There is the end of a particular life at a particular level. So this person may have been a very respected yogi, intellectual, and may have had a lot of influence and renown in a previous life, and merit and goodness and dharma in their living practice. But there was still the infatuation with fame, desire mm-hmm. for glory and recognition. So this is what that probably happens, or this is what takes place when the spiritual movement becomes interrupted. And these are topics that are well outlined and elaborated in the Bhagavad Gita. That when a life ends, that's without the fulfillment of the highest benediction or perfection, which would be sthita prajna, the sage established in wisdom. Because wisdom comes to everyone. I've heard mothers of children that are psychiatrically challenged say that, my child had a moment of extraordinary insight, and my child is brilliant in spite of his suffering. So, yes, every spirit, every living being is capable of flashes of intuition, no mm-hmm. matter what challenges the spirit or the individual has to face in a given lifetime.
Okay.
But it doesn't mean that individual is established in wisdom. The
gotcha.
Sage is, you see what I mean, is establishing wisdom, has no desire for calling the attention of others to call the attention for selfish purposes or because
yeah,
what
so,
that turns.
So doing that yeah, sort of thing is a, kind of a red flag.
It's a red flag that he's in need of, it's like a circus. It's like he becomes the entertainment. Right,
yeah,
he calls attention, he's like an entertainer of
right.
people's desire to see magic.
Right,
but
right,
it,
right.
It becomes, it becomes shallow because magic is all around us, as you
right,
very
right.
well.
That's how you define it.
You're right, right. Yes, the spiritual magic.
Mm-hmm. just to try to bring us back on track. I'm sorry, I took you off track. Before our time slips away here because it does go so quickly. You wanted to talk about goddesses mothering women leaders, or goddesses mothering women wisdom leaders. So why don't you talk a little bit about that and how India's goddess traditions fulfill that that idea?
Well, it is little known in our times or in the West right now, in mainstream academics, even in Hindu studies, with the exception of very few that are aware that in India the goddess tradition informs women on a higher standard of ethics and political conscience for the good of humanity. But there are two particular works on the life of enlightened women that I would like to bring to the attention of more people. I'm still writing about them. And they are within the context of a classic in India that's called the Yoga Vashishta. But the Yoga Vashishta is a story of the guru of Sri Rama. As you know, Sri Rama is the incarnation husband of Sita. from the Ramayana, and even centuries before or millennia or mythological time beyond what we can imagine, in the Vedas, Rama's life story began very similar to the life of the Buddha. He was depressed when he was an adolescent, when he realized that life ended in a sickness. There was a food chain, there was sickness, there was death and old age and death. So when he was a teenager, he required the teachings of a guru to bring him out of that that spiritual depression. And that is what the story of Yoga Vasishtha is about. Within that voluminous, I believe that the Yoga Vasishtha is in Sanskrit. There are about 8 or 9 tomes of about 3 or 4 inches thick each tome. And in that story, and story within story, there are the stories of 2 enlightened queens in India who are very important to help women today in the transformation of women and mothers to embody goddess presence and goddess social and cultural consciousness for women today. And the stories are the story of Queen Leela and the story of Queen Shudala. These two are, one of them is the story of Leela is the story of a woman who lost her husband, the king, and she invoked the grace of Goddess Saraswati to follow him through astral travels as he transmigrated from one body to another. And she gained, through these psychic experiences with the goddess, she learned the mysteries of life, rebirth, and enlightenment, and freedom from the cycles of life and death. In the story of Queen Shudala, is extraordinary in very different ways. The story of Queen Shudala is the story of a woman who was the wife of a king in spiritual practices. They were both devoted to Vedic and non-dualistic practices, pretty much like a king and a queen who are following monastic life. And one day he tells her, why is it that the more years we live together, I see you younger and younger and more effulgent and more and bright and youthful with the passing of time. How come? And to this question, she answered, it is because I have attained the goal of human existence, moksha, liberation. And her husband laughed, like most men would laugh at the wife right at her face. He said, you're ridiculous. You're a woman. You live in luxury. You haven't done anything to deserve this. Most men and monks have to practice austerities and sacrifices, one embodiment after another, to be deserving of this merit. So, and with that in mind, he went into the forest. He left her in charge of the kingdom and told her, I'm going to teach you what enlightenment is like. I will go into forest life. And to make the long story short, the king goes into forest life for about 18 years. And after this period of about 18 years, Queen Shudala, as enlightened queen, had practiced, had done certain practices to develop psychic abilities. And she went to the forest, invisible, disguised in an invisible form, and realized that her husband was stuck with his own, the same typical mental constructs that he had when he lived in the kingdom with her, that he had not evolved much living in the forest. He was having the same issues with every critter for every animal that lived in the forest. He had the same mental frames and discrimination and limitations and discriminations and prejudices. So she assisted him. In order to help him, knowing that her husband, who was going to be her disciple now, and she was going to become the guru of the husband, to teach him the mystic path to enlightenment, knowing that being in a female form, he would not accept her as an enlightened being. She changed her form through psychic powers and appeared before him in the form of a male Muni. A Muni is a male sage in a young form, in a young body. She appeared to him as a young Muni, a young sage, and gave him instructions. And that is, the story, we get into the story of Queen Sudala, which is an extraordinary story. And I don't think we have time, but...
No, we're starting to run short.
Let me ask you
a question that maybe you're better qualified to answer than say some Western women who just study India's goddesses from afar. If India's women are informed by goddess. And after all, India is a country that has never lost the goddess like so many other parts of the world. She's been there for thousands of years. Indian people have never let go of goddess. Why do you suspect that Indian culture is still so heavily patriarchal that you still have the bride burnings. You still have.
Bride burning. Okay, I understand. I understand your question. Let me see. Because then, when you bring in the topic of sati and bride burning, then my response becomes a lot more complex and.
We need a short answer, and
you need a short answer. So I will steer away from bride burning, but address your question in this way because I've heard the question before. What most people in the West forget is that India's extraordinary culture and the wisdom of Indian sages and yogis was the envy of the Greeks. We even sent Alexander to con an Indian yogi to come to Greece and establish forums and discussions with the Greek philosophers because of this extraordinary attention that India drew from the rest of the world. India became enslaved by colonial powers for over 800 years. In the last 200 years, India was the colony of England. But before England, India was oppressed by one colonial invasion after another. When a country is invaded by colonialism and colonial oppression and hegemony in the way that India was oppressed and the backbone of its people was almost destroyed, not fully destroyed by the grace of goddess and all the gods of India. Because in India, the trees are sages, the rivers are goddess Ganga, the land is sacred, there are caves that are the inside of the body of mother, everything is sacred. India is coming out of 800 years of colonial oppression and destruction. In my heart, I visited India after I had been a disciple of great guru for 22 years living in the ashram and 7 years after meeting Ma Yoga Shakti, who is an extraordinary, she's a topic of an essay in herself or a topic of a book that is upcoming with the blessings of Mother. But what few are noticing is that the, you know, it is the destruction of colonial influence, the destruction of imperial, the colonialism and imperialism, yes.
So let me ask you this, and tell me if you believe there's any credibility to this, or maybe it's just a part of the picture. What some of the Western women scholars have said is that one of the reasons India is, I've never heard them mention colonialism or imperialism, but that does make perfect sense to me, what you're saying. But the reason they gave for goddess not having more of an influence, for women not being more in charge, you know, the reason why maybe India is still so patriarchal is because the goddesses, they have been domesticated. The goddesses, instead of retaining their full power, are now some god's wife. You know, they've been relegated to spouse rather than the full, you know, the full power and glory that they once were. So by association, women then too become diminished. Do you think there's any validity to that?
There may be validity in particular cases. I cannot, no one would deny that, I suppose. There are particular cases, and there are individuals who, in India, who follow the law of Manu, which is another patriarchal construct and particular dogma of the Hindu tradition, or the Hindu religion, let's say, because Hinduism is like a religion, even though it doesn't have a Vatican, like the Catholic Church has a Vatican or a headquarter, mm-hmm. but Hinduism is the religion, the masses aspect of the Vedic tradition. However, there is the influence of Western patriarchy in the last 200 years of British colonialism. The invasion of the North has had extraordinary influence on diminishing and ridiculing the Vedic tradition. Even in the last last two centuries, everyone from India who was educated in India or people like Sri Aurobindo and Krishnamurti, who were educated in England, they were informed about the Vedic tradition through a lens of the Western eyes. They were informed about the history of India written through the lens of British scholars. So the goddess in India, the goddess in the classical text of the goddess of India, the Devi Mahatmya from Markandeya Puranas, in the Devi Mahatmya, the goddess is not the consort of any male god. The goddess alone is. The interpretation, which is not the interpretation that in my parampara, in my lineage of guru disciple and previous teachers of my teachers, that hermeneutic interpretation of the goddess being a consort is a it fulfills the patriarchal fulfills the patriarchal ego. We can say in terms of the
so
fact
you're
that
saying,
it's like a,
so
yeah.
You're saying India itself, because it was under the thumb of colonialism, the colonialism actually affected their spirituality and sort of warped, shall we say, warped,
yes,
in a sense, the power,
yes,
of goddess, you know, brought that whole, you know, women is less than idea to India, and the people in India accepted it, or over time it became the norm. Is that what you're saying?
Well, yes. You see how in this country, for example, people are polarized. Most people,
yeah,
are polarized. Let's say not a few of us may not be polarized by two parties, right? And in order to earn a living and support a family, people that are normally good people that you wouldn't, if you really pin them down to the fundamental questions of life and ethics, they would definitely decry that they don't believe in what they're doing. But they're actually doing what the leaders of these two parties are standing for, which are, you know, unending wars, of genocidal wars around the world and interventions in other parts of the world. So people in India of the time of Sri Aurobindo, late 1800s, early 1900s, and even before, who were progressives, who were interested in the better education for their children, had their children study the history of India written by British scholars. And what was the interest of the British crown? What was what the scholars were paid to write? It was the same as what most scholars in the United States right now are paid to write history. Not the history that we know that is the history from the point of view of the First Nation people of this country. You know, it's the point of view of those in power will always require that those who are colonized ingratiate themselves or attach themselves to the ways, to the standpoints, right, and the world views of those of the hierarchy, the ones in the top of the hierarchy.
Well, yeah, so I mean, that, it makes, I think about, you know, how the English didn't understand Kali, you know, and or any of her people, you know, and they got that derogatory title, the Thuggies, because, you know, they looked at Kali and, you know, they had no idea what she was about. And so, you know, they couldn't understand the full potency and importance of who she was.
And I do understand even Kali or even Ganesha, the god that is an elephant. You know, I've heard here that some Hindus have to defend in some forums in California or somewhere that in U.S. history books, Ganesha is being described as a Hindu god with a phallus nose, phallic nose. And, you know, in how can people, you know, our children, how are children? I have a Ganesha in the very entrance of my house, and I have children that go to school here in the United States who are neighbors and come and visit my house, and they have asked, isn't that God the one that is bathed with milk? And well, they're looking at that father's nose and talking about it, you know. And they said, you know, how would you feel if you lived in a country where elephants walk in the streets? Wouldn't that impress on you how majestic this animal is? Wouldn't that give you a sense of dignity? Wouldn't you think that even the sages describe the nose of the elephant as a, it has two functions. It has the function, it has a function of action, and it also has a, it's an organ of action and an organ of perception. The elephant pulls logs of wood and draws them or lifts them with the trunk. It's like a hand.
And it's
also an organ of perception. They smell and they breathe. So these are, so our
You're
ignorance,
talking about the unaware. These people are unaware.
Lack of awareness.
Lack of awareness. Well, Brenda, we only have 3 minutes left. You know, I know we haven't really explored the subject as fully as we hoped we would, but I am going to have to, you know, say goodnight because we are about to go off the air. So I want to thank you for your time, you know, to, you know, bring what you were able to get across to listeners. And I appreciate, you know, your wisdom and perspective. So thank you very much.
You're welcome. It's been my pleasure. Thank you so much, Karen. And thank you. Thanks to your listeners.
All right. Good night.
Good night. Namaste.
Namaste. Well, as I close tonight's show very quickly, I ask you to tune in next week on Tuesday because of the July 4th holiday. I will not be in town on Wednesday or Thursday. I'll be interviewing Carol Brody Fleet about surviving and thriving after one's partner dies and you find yourself a widow. Then Betsy Lewis will be with us. She's an intuitive and earth mysteries investigator and author of Angels, Aliens, and Prophecy, The Connection. We'll explain her insights on how a mass UFO sighting, such as the well-documented one over Phoenix in 1997, is connected to the apparition of Our Lady of Fatima in Portugal. We'll get into what happened during her regression session, recalling her and her mother's abduction, and if people in Japan were warned about the impending tsunami by ETs. Lots of other stuff. We're a little off our subject, but I think you'll enjoy the show. It sounds like it's right off the Sci-Fi Channel. So please, listeners, I will just say good night, and may Goddess embrace you in her golden wings. Thank you.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on ChumbaCasino.com. I looked over the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's ChumbaCasino.com and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.